the clearer it becomes that the assault on the Whistler mural is a textbook case of a modern mobbing by extreme activists. The Instagram account White Pube, which started the pressure on the Tate, has been described by no less an expert than Vogue as the self-styled cowboy critics shaking up the arts establishment. The account is run by people who claim that the arts in Britain are dominated by white middle-class people, as well they might be in a country that is still majority white. But the White Pube cowboys are after more than just increasing access or representation in the arts. One of their posts, written in June 2020, states, "Fuck the police, fuck the state, fuck the Tate, riots and reform," which, with the exception of one clause, is bog-standard revolutionary fare. But it is still not entirely commonplace for the chant of "fuck the police" to be followed by "fuck the Tate," or indeed to "fuck any other art collection." But this is the fare that White Pube deals in, and their small support base eggs them on. As one of their supporters wrote after White Pube had got the Whistler mural in their sights, "Never knew there was a basement restaurant, let alone a white supremacist basement restaurant." Perhaps it is unsurprising that once this anti-Whistler mural campaign gained traction, some politicians sought to join in. One such was Diane Abbott, the Labour MP who just 4 months earlier had been Shadow Home Secretary. When the campaign was at its height, Abbott tweeted, "I have eaten in Rex Whistler restaurant at Tate Britain. Had no idea famous mural had repellent images of black slaves. Museum management need to move the restaurant. Nobody should be eating surrounded by imagery of black slaves." The post was accompanied by two incriminating images, one, incidentally, from a different painting. Abbott finished this off with the hashtag Black Lives Matter. What is more interesting even than the ill will of these instigators is how far they were able to run. For what is most telling about the Whistler mural affair is not that shrill and over-megaphoned voices made their voices heard, nor that a work of art should suffer such a stratospheric context collapse. Rather, it is that the trustees of the Tate, whose job is to safeguard a historic national collection, should instead have stood judgment over a work in its care and misrepresented it so obscenely. Because of them, the most amusing room in Europe turned in a matter of months into a white supremacist restaurant that celebrated slavery. What might they have done instead? They might have said that the characters being complained about were the tiniest imaginable details in a work positively bursting with details. They might have pointed out that art galleries such as the Tate are absolutely chock-full of artistic details that might be considered disturbing. The Renaissance galleries are packed with crucifixions and martyrdoms. Most galleries have significant numbers of nude or semi-nude bodies. There are generally a few rapes. And the modern galleries, not least the exhibitions for the finalists of the Turner Prize, which the Tate hosts each year, display things that Whistler would never have imagined in his worst nightmares. The trustees might have bothered to resist as ahistorical and anti-artistic the imposition of George Floyd onto a delicate and whimsical work of art created a century earlier. And they might have pointed out that a work of art and a political manifesto are different things. That just as a novel that mentions slavery does not mean that the novelist is celebrating slavery, so a work of art depicting something evil does not mean that the artist is somehow urging for it to happen. Yet the Tate's trustees did none of these things. Instead, they accepted that the steamroller of modern political fashion had every right to crush a work in their care. They effectively conceded the appalling claim that Rex Whistler was some kind of pro-slavery, pro-empire, racist, white supremacist. And since Whistler does not make the news very often, and was killed before he could leave any direct descendants to defend him, such an outsize and outlandish claim has a chance of sticking. So it is that 80 years after he gave his life fighting Nazism, Whistler now stands besmirched by the gallery he spent months toiling away for. Watching Rex Whistler getting put through the vengeful spin cycle of this is somehow worse than watching some other cases. His art was never political, and was never meant to have to prove itself by such willfully hostile modern lights. Racist literature. Unfortunately, the cycle that Whistler was put through is not one that only he has gone through. In the last few years, almost every great figure in the history of Western art has been put through the exact same process, always at the hands of people who range from the semi-informed to the uninformed, always subjected to the same coarse form of attack, and almost always responded to by people in charge of some of our great cultural institutions, alleged guardians of the heritage, who run up the white flag of surrender the moment the first shot is fired by people who are clearly bad actors. Nearly everything in literary history has now been subjected to the same dulling, remorseless, Kendi-ish maltreatment. Universities that have announced that their curriculums are going to be decolonized or diversified always fall into the same remorseless groove. In his 1977 work, Marxism and Literature, Raymond Williams infamously declared that in the far-reaching cultural revolution to come, it would be necessary for everything to go, all the acquisitions of civilization, including literature itself. Even Williams's most devoted followers had trouble with this suggestion, not least because nearly all of them held university chairs in the study of literature. But in his hope for a future where all literature would be swept out of the way, leaving a memory only of the present, he seems now to have been ahead of his time. In January 2021, academics in the English department at the University of Leicester were given two pieces of good news. The first was that a round of redundancies could be expected. The second was that the department was henceforth going to provide a decolonized curriculum that would be dedicated to diversity. Faculty were told that this meant that medieval literature would stop being taught and that the teaching of early modern literature would be reduced. So out would go Beowulf and the works of Geoffrey Chaucer, and in would come what? The university insisted that Shakespeare was safe, but President and Vice-Chancellor Professor Nishan Kanagaraja said that it was necessary to change the course in order to be sustainable and to compete on a global level. What this meant in principle was that students would study a chronological span of English literature from Shakespeare to Bernardine Evaristo. Such courses would allow a chronological study of literature with modules on race, ethnicity, sexuality and diversity, a decolonized curriculum, and so on. Perhaps people should have been grateful that Shakespeare could still get a look in, but only a short while later it looked as if the Bard of Stratford-upon-Avon might be for the chop, or at least for the severe cutting, in one of the places that was meant to uphold, celebrate, and sustain his legacy. In May 2021, Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London announced that it, too, was seeking to become anti-racist and intending to decolonize Shakespeare. The theatre on the south side of the Thames is near the site of the playwright's original playhouse and was reconstructed at enormous expense in the 1990s. Audiences were meant to be treated to seeing Shakespeare's work there in the setting for which he originally wrote the works, and for years tourists and locals alike rejoiced in the opportunity. But nothing is safe from the precepts of CRT, and the Globe's anti-racist seminars dedicated to trying to decolonize Shakespeare's plays appear to have unfolded in the usual manner. Experts claimed that Shakespeare's plays are problematic, which they may well be, but these experts meant the term only in the same dull and reductive tenor in which everything else in the era plays. The crack squad of Shakespeare scholars who the Globe unleashed included one who first complained that in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the character Lysander says at one point, "Who would not trade a raven for a dove?" and then complained that this meant that Shakespeare associated whiteness with beauty and blackness with ugliness. Others claimed that Shakespeare used terms such as fair to denote someone good. And meanwhile, one Dr. Vanessa Corredera from Andrew University in Michigan claimed that all of Shakespeare's plays are race plays and contain racialized dynamics. By Dr. Corredera's standards, it was clear that Shakespeare is a very sloppy writer. Talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream, she said, "In context with other plays and even the sonnets, this language is all over the place, this language of dark and light. These are racializing elements." It is an interesting claim, this, by a professor of English literature, that Shakespeare's language is all over the place. Before the recent racialized revolt, scholars of English had generally admired Shakespeare's way with words. But it takes a course of decolonizing and an anti-racism agenda to turn even that around, and for a place that is meant to protect the legacy of Shakespeare, to commission and then respectfully listen to scholars whose own words and scholarship are so fantastically hostile and inept toward him. Inevitably, the Globe denied that it was assaulting Shakespeare and claimed that his reputation was safe, but there were already signs, which they should have been aware of, that this was not so. Only months earlier, the School Library Journal had run a debate on whether Shakespeare's works should still be taught in American classrooms. According to one expert, Shakespeare's works are full of problematic, outdated ideas, with plenty of misogyny, racism, homophobia, classism, anti-Semitism, and misogynoir. She concluded that educators in America are coming to the conclusion that it's time for Shakespeare to be set aside and de-emphasized to make room for modern, diverse, and inclusive voices. A former Washington State public school teacher, meanwhile, said that she had already eliminated Shakespeare from her classroom in order to stray from centering the narrative of white, cisgender, heterosexual men. Eliminating Shakespeare was a step I could easily take to work toward that. Another teacher, a head of English at a high school in Michigan, said that teachers must challenge the whiteness of the claim that Shakespeare's works are universal. In response to these and other outlandish claims, Ayanna Thompson, a professor of English at Arizona State University and the president of the Shakespeare Association of America, said that teachers should continue to teach Shakespeare, but should do so alongside more diverse writers, such as Toni Morrison. This was suggested like a plea bargain, and as though no one had taught any black writer before, and that lovers of Shakespeare needed to put in some type of mitigating plea if their idol was going to be allowed to remain. The more this goes on, the harder it is to find any author who is deemed to pass any muster whatsoever. A Massachusetts school was one of those to ban Homer, deeming the Odyssey as just one part of a canon of texts by dead white men that were problematic. In such judgments, you see the whole canon of English literature being not reinterpreted, but simply deemed inadmissible. Students are told that all literature before the present day was abhorrent, and are then ordered to have extra portions of Toni Morrison instead. But at least Shakespeare was being assailed through an illiterate assault on his works. Other writers were not so lucky. In fact, at the same time, other writers were being blacklisted not for anything they had ever written or said, but for ancestors who they could never even have met. In the anti-racist stampede of 2020, the British Library announced that it had made a commitment to its staff and its users that it will become an actively anti-racist organisation and will take all the necessary steps required to make this promise a reality. As one part of this great commitment, the Library announced that it was working to create a list of authors who were found to have any connection to the slave trade or colonialism. As it was forming this blacklist of authors, news of some of the names that had been put on it were published online by the Library. The initial list contained the names of 300 guilty parties, including Oscar Wilde, Lord Byron, and George Orwell. The Library explained that some items now at the British Library, previously owned by particular figures cited in these pages, are associated with wealth obtained from enslaved people or through colonial violence. Curators in the Printed Heritage Collections team have undertaken some research to identify these as part of an ongoing work to interpret and document the provenance and history of the printed collections under our care. These curators made many early discoveries from their research. One such was that the author Rudyard Kipling was guilty of having made the British Empire a central theme in his literary output. Clearly, only the best researchers are hired at the British Library. One of these, the chief librarian, Liz Jolly, used the moment to publicly announce that racism is the creation of white people. Elsewhere, the Library said that although the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge had expressed anti-slavery views himself and had recorded these views in his poetry, he was on the blacklist nonetheless, because he was recorded as having a nephew who lived in Barbados and worked closely with estates where there were slaves. The sins of the father is a familiar problem, but the sins of the people known to the nephew is a new form of associative guilt. Still, the blacklist became more ridiculous, because one of the people on it, to the surprise of many, was the former poet laureate Ted Hughes. Hughes was born in 1930, some years after the slave trade was ended, and at too young an age to have any significant effect on the last days of empire. He died in 1998, yet still the British Library added him to its dossier of wrongdoers. The reason was that the sleuths who were employed at taxpayer expense claimed they had found that one of Hughes's ancestors, Nicholas Ferrer, was deeply involved with the London Virginia Company, which helped to set up colonies in North America. Of course, there was no claim that Hughes had any connection with Ferrer, because he was born in 1592, and even the British Library's research squad had worked out that they could not smear Hughes by direct link. Nevertheless, they insisted that he was one of those who fitted their blacklist criteria of being a person with connections to slavery, or someone who had profited from slavery or colonialism. The Library's researchers had clearly not done any research into the extent to which Hughes might have benefited from this ancestor. He was born and brought up in a poor part of Yorkshire. His father ran a tobacco shop, and Hughes made it to Cambridge University on a scholarship, making his career and what money he did from his own work. On this occasion, there was a short and sharp intervention from some of the few remaining adults in the room. First, some actual, real-life researchers not employed by the library did the most basic, cursory work. They pointed out that aside from the absurdity of trying to damn Hughes by association with a man alive in the time of Shakespeare, there were other distinct problems with the library's claim. For it transpired that Nicholas Ferrer had died without children. So even if Ted Hughes was related to him, it could not have been as a direct descendant. They also pointed out that Nicholas Ferrer was actually the author of a pamphlet attacking slavery before the British slave trade had even begun. The library smeared one of the 20th century's great poets by connecting him to a non-relation who had died centuries earlier and was opposed to the slave trade. It was not an optimal start for the British Library's project, and the estate of Ted Hughes clearly stepped in to demand an unqualified apology, which was forthcoming. The library announced that it wished to apologise to Mrs. Carol Hughes and to family members and friends, owing to a reference included in the spreadsheet to a distant ancestor, which we withdraw unreservedly. The library promised not to repeat the accusation and apologised for the distress caused. Hughes's widow welcomed the apology while lamenting the library's highly misleading comments. There are several reminders in this affair. One is that the people who claim to know what they are talking about do not. They are mostly ignorant, sloppy, and less than half-informed. The other is that the slightest firm pushback can bring about a reversal. So, why does this not happen more often? Why is it that the same language, ideas, assertions, and dogmatisms are able to run through everything? For that is what they have done. It doesn't matter how delicate or profound the subject, how frivolous or deep it might be. Everything is inspected under the same remorseless light, and everything comes out looking equally and eternally guilty. Racist gardening. Sometimes it is great literature. At other times it can be something as light and apparently carefree as gardening. In March 2021, it was Kew Gardens that came under the spotlight. That was when the head of the largest botanic gardens in Britain gave an interview to The Guardian to hit back at claims that the publicly funded gardens he managed had been growing woke. The cause of the complaints had been the recent publication of a 10-year manifesto that had recently appeared, which said that the 5 key priorities for Kew in the next decade included having conversations about its links to imperialism and colonialism. Kew, obviously predictably, said that it intended to decolonize and acknowledge its exploitative and racist legacies. Richard Deverell, formerly of the BBC, chose to hit back at criticisms of this agenda, and did so in strident terms. So, in the pages of The Guardian, he announced that it was no longer possible to stay silent. "We are at a fork in the road moment," Deverell said with great conviction. The outpouring of feeling around the world at the death of George Floyd meant that long-standing injustices had to be faced up to. Kew Gardens could not and would not stand aside in this great reckoning. Like so many other organisations, Parts of Kew's history shamefully draw from a legacy that has deep roots in colonialism and racism, said Deverell. Much of Kew's work in the 19th century focused on the movement of valuable plants around the British Empire for agriculture and trade, which of course means that some key figures in our past and items still in our collections are linked to colonialism. The Kew botanist, Sophie Richards, who is of Caribbean heritage, agreed with him. "We shouldn't forget," she said, "that plants were central to the running of the British Empire." But what does it mean, practically, to decolonise a garden? Mr. Deverell had part of an answer. For more than 260 years, scientists from Kew have explored every corner of the world, documenting the rich diversity of plants and fungi. We were beacons of discovery and science, but also beacons of privilege and exploitation, he said. He also added that there is no acceptable neutral position on this subject. To stay silent is to be complicit. Each of us needs to step up to tackle injustices in our society. Yet, what is the head of a botanical garden to do? The one concrete idea Deverell seemed to have at this fork-in-the-road moment was to change the display boards and descriptions. For instance, the mention of sugar and rubber plants would be changed to reflect their links to slavery and colonialism. Elsewhere, he claimed that the gardens had been loose with their descriptive language in the past. They had referred to certain plants as having been discovered at certain times. The eagle-eyed Deverell was quick to point out that many of these plants had been known about by indigenous communities for years before Western botanists and explorers came across them. Which, indeed, they may have been, but they were still discovered by the people who found them there and brought them to a wider audience that has been able to appreciate them ever since. Casting directors discover movie stars, and your friends discover a great restaurant across town. There need not be anything sinister about such a description. To quibble with it is to try to satisfy a grandiose claim with a piece of pedantry. But that seemed to be all Mr. Deverell had in his armoury. His other main suggestion was to make sure that people do not feel intimidated by the Victorian wrought iron gates of Kew, as though there were friendly wrought iron gates and unfriendly wrought iron gates, and it is necessary to land on the right side of this divide, as all others. Nor was Kew the only such culprit. Indeed, the world of gardening turned out to be as resentful and desiring of offence as every other realm of society. Kew had recently released a gardening podcast called Dirt on Our Hands, Overcoming Botany's Hidden Legacy of Inequality. In it, the BBC broadcaster James Wong had set out to explore the inequality and racism that lie behind the seemingly democratic and wholesome world of plants. Unsurprisingly, it turned out to be as seethingly racist as everything else. According to Wong, who is half Malaysian, somebody at the Chelsea Flower Show once complimented him on his wonderful English. On other occasions, visitors to the horticultural display had, he said, assumed that he would only be interested in tropical gardens. Another garden historian and presenter of the BBC's Gardener's World, Advolly Richmond, claimed that she often gets double takes because sometimes I am the only black face in many, many situations to do with gardens and gardening. Wong took to the pages of The Guardian to say that the great joy of the natural world is that it can transcend gender, class, race, sexuality, and political persuasions. And yet, he insisted in a piece titled Weeding Out Horticulture's Race Problem, it would come as a surprise to many people how much of a systemic problem racism is within the seemingly friendly, mild-mannered world of horticulture. Though, of course, readers of The Guardian would most likely not have been surprised at all by the deceptively friendly face of horticulture. In fact, the bigotry seething behind the mild-mannered facade would most likely have been just what lefty readers had been primed to see around every corner. For, in the November after the death of George Floyd, Wong had already taken to the paper to argue in favour of the politicisation of gardening. As the headline read, "Other arts are political. Why not gardening?" Wong attacked people he had overheard at the Hampton Court flower show 5 years earlier, who had complained that a horticultural installation that was inspired by the issues facing displaced people around the world was bringing politics into gardening. The complaint was quite wrong, he said. Since everything should be politicised, why should gardening not be? Examples of low bigotries in the world of gardening included that words such as native and heritage were used as bywords for better. Later, on social media, Wong reacted to a professor of cities and landscape who asserted that gardens are denied their political agency because they too often reveal uncomfortable politics. Wong asserted, even more boldly, that British gardening has racism baked into its DNA. On this occasion, his evidence was that presenting a planting concept once to a room full of 100% white people, someone said that they should use native wildflowers. The idea of native wildflowers was, he said, not just historically fucked, but predicated on often unconscious ideas of what and who does not belong in the UK. This is the kind of exhausting shit you have to go through every day if you work in UK horticulture. All this certainly spoke to The Guardian's view. In an editorial supporting the head of Kew Gardens, the paper concluded that the ties of rhododendrons and flowering magnolia at Kew should not distract the visitor. The botanical gardens are not just green spaces for exercise and diversion. They were places that had been used for botanical research and an appeal to science, yet were far from apolitical. Such gardens came from an elitist Western pursuit for the exotic, often collected with economic purposes in mind. The white men who did this had an agenda. As the paper's headline blared, "The Guardian View on Botanical Gardens, Inextricably Linked to Empire." Like everything else, you might say. While Britain was waging war on the rhododendrons, in Canada, emphasis fell on the unsuspecting lawns. In September 2020, John Douglas, a history professor at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, gained national attention when he argued the urgent case for decolonizing Canada's lawns. According to Professor Douglas, the lawn is a statement of control over nature, which it is, of course. But in the current era, it is not enough to observe that. The sprinklers of anti-Western hostility must also be turned on. So Professor Douglas could be found arguing that all this attempt to dam water, plant lawns, flatten landscapes, and find a non-indigenous species of plant to put in it was yet another example of a now familiar pattern. A backyard with a big lawn is like a classroom for colonialism, he explained. Others joined in this game. According to Dan Krause, a senior conservation biologist at the Nature Conservancy of Canada, a lawn, like a nation, should be diverse. It is a cultural thing, he has said. There is this interesting comparison, like valuing diversity versus sameness. He believes that future generations may look back at non-culturally diverse lawns in bafflement and say, "Why did you do that?" Which is possible. Or alternatively, future generations may look back at Mr. Krause and feel another bafflement entirely. Racist music. Because one of the things that has made the West is its openness to ideas and influences. The history of the West is a history of gathering knowledge wherever it could be found. A history of collecting plants, ideas, languages, and styles, not in order to subjugate or steal them, but to learn from them. Nevertheless, there is now not a realm of life and culture so delicate or so sacrosanct that this era's omnipresent, omnirelevant ideology, asserting precisely the opposite of that tradition of openness, cannot sweep through it. Always with the same remorseless dogmatism with which it sweeps across everything else. In the post-Floyd summer of 2020, classical music was one of the surprising targets, though this had been building for some while. In 2015, the Oxford Handbook series saw fit to add a new title to its catalogue, the Oxford Handbook of Social Justice in Music Education. Among the suggestions of this book were that music competitions ought to end and be replaced by drawing attention to economic inequality, that music ought to be about politics, that music education in North America is a part of an obvious agenda of cultural whiteness, and that the posture that performers adopt on stage is racist. It argued that cultural changes mean that we should stop taking musical notation seriously, that political activism is the highest form of education, and that to fight existing power structures, we should seek not just to teach hip-hop, but to be hip-hop, whatever that means. At any rate, precisely how hip-hop can a white man hope to be without getting into trouble? In any case, the activists' sights had been set for some years in preparation for the move against American orchestras that occurred in the summer of 2020. An issue that had been going around for years, that of the demographic makeup of audiences and performers, was once again brought out as a cultural battering ram. For decades, orchestras and other classical music groups had been working to increase the numbers of female players and ethnic minority players in their ranks. As a result of a long debate, one of the tools that many orchestras came up with was to institute a process of blind auditions. The idea was, of course, to ensure that any interview panel deciding on a particular player's competency would not be influenced by the visual giveaway of whether the person was female or from an ethnic minority. For years, this was deemed to be a progressive move, and many people partially attribute the rise in minority representation in orchestras to it. In 2016, one of the trombonists in the orchestra at the Metropolitan Opera, Weston Sprott, who also teaches at the Juilliard School, came out forcefully for blind auditions. "In my experience," he said, "I have been the winner of numerous auditions where a screen was present from start to finish, but I have never won a professional audition where the screen came down. If you're serious about diversifying your ensemble, the first of many steps is to raise the screen and let your ears, not your eyes, guide your artistic convictions. Diversity will follow." But then, in 2020, you could almost hear the gearbox crunch as the principles of the process were suddenly reversed. All of a sudden, blind auditions were the problem. As the New York Times blared in a headline during July 2020, "To make orchestras more diverse, end blind auditions." For that month's consensus was that if orchestras were to be more diverse, then rather than ignore race or give everybody the same chance by having blind auditions, they should instead be made to take into account race, gender, and other factors. While the paper acknowledged that blind auditions had been transformative in increasing the number of female players in orchestras, it claimed that there was not enough change in the racial makeup of orchestras. "The status quo is not working," said the paper. "Blind auditions are no longer tenable, and while the policy had been well-intentioned, it had now, allegedly, impeded diversity." There may be a number of reasons for underrepresentation in orchestras. For instance, it is possible that there are simply not enough young black Americans being trained up as classical performers. Whatever the reasons for that, one solution would be to increase classical music aid across the American schooling system, especially in black majority schools. But, as is the case so often, this would be too big an issue to address. Whereas beating up on orchestra boards for not having enough black players in their orchestra is a relatively cost-free exercise. The argument for incremental change, which had been one argument in classical music circles for years, was suddenly deemed to be part of the problem. According to the New York Times' chief classical music critic, slow and steady change is no longer fast enough. Still, this suggested that the problem was easy to solve, either to raise the screens or to bring them down. But even on this, no one can agree. Anthony McGill, the principal clarinetist of the New York Philharmonic, who happens to be black, says, "I don't know what the right answers are." And it is noticeable that in a follow-up piece titled "Black Artists on How to Change Classical Music," the New York Times could not find a single black musician who supported the idea of stopping blind auditions. The National Alliance for Audition Support, an initiative designed to increase representation in American orchestras, claims that aspects of our audition/tenure processes continue to contribute to the legacy of systemic racism that has existed in our country since before the very first orchestra was founded. It says that training in anti-racism, implicit bias, and group communication skills are imperative at all levels of orchestral management and support. But its 2021 guidelines also call for screens to be up throughout all stages of the audition process, as well as insist on no screening of resumes. Whether pro or anti-screening, all of this has one thing in common. It is presented under one unarguable premise, that classical music is a white-dominated field, as the New York Times said, and must, therefore, be transformed. The point began to be made endlessly. In July, it was the opera's turn. "Opera can no longer ignore its race problem," claimed the New York Times. On the very same day, the Washington Post decided to go with, "That sound you're hearing is classical music's long overdue reckoning with racism." This prominent piece asserted that systemic racism runs like rot through the structures of the classical music world. It claimed that institutions must correct the imbalances that keep the classical stage so habitually tilted and tinted white. As an example, the Post presented the Kennedy Center, which had recently arranged a Zoom call with community arts leaders, in which the center's vice president, Mark Bamuti Joseph, stressed the center's desire to commission anti-racism works. For, as he said, the center's goal is to make anti-racism systemic. What happened to the goal of such a center simply being to perform the best work possible? After all, there is nothing wrong with white people being in an audience, any more than there is anything wrong with white people being in a congregation. If there are not enough black people in a particular gathering, it doesn't make the gathering wrong. It may just not appeal to everyone. And it should be possible to make some peace with that, or affect it, without insisting that the cause must be racism. Yet the same juggernaut goes through everything. The Baltimore Symphony Orchestra asserts in its 2021 charter that diversity, racial equity, and inclusion are strategic imperatives to the success of the BSO's second century. Furthermore, it says, we believe it to be inherently within the BSO's mission to celebrate the arts and reject systemic racism in all its forms. We recognize that the legacy of white privilege persists across our entire organization, and we pledge to transform this institution in partnership with our musicians, administrative staff, patrons, and community. In the last 2 years, this same trend has swept through every part of the musical world. In the dash not to remain on the wrong side of a stampede, there has been a constant drive to find more black composers from the past and present. At least one major Baroque ensemble in America has found itself caught in this trap, because, of course, the music it plays is all by dead white composers. Still, its board is demanding that this Baroque ensemble play new music in order that it can play music by black composers. If people thought it was hard to find the required number of black composers working today, wait till they try to find black composers willing to compose in a Baroque idiom. In other cases, orchestras have already begun to part ways with music directors and others not willing to fire existing players and replace them with black players. In at least one case in the United States, the victim of the resulting purge has been a musician of Asian origin, meaning that in the name of increasing ethnic minority representation, the institution has eased out an existing musician from a minority. Because while few black artists need help reaching the top of the world's pop charts, it has been decided that they do need to be pushed to the top of the Baroque music scene. Perhaps it is inevitable, in a world in which everything else is racist, that even the fundamentals of music would be branded in the same light. In the last generation, there has been an increasing drive at the top universities in the Western world to drop the very idea of musical notation because of its allegedly elitist white and Western connotations. At universities including Stanford, Harvard, and Yale, there has been an ongoing debate over what demands they should make of those reading music. Should students be expected to learn about the canon of Western music? Should they even be expected to learn the Western system of musical notation, given that it is just one form of musical notation, and Western at that? Should the study of music demand any prior musical literacy at all? The problem is in most ways a new one. Earlier generations of ethnomusicologists tended to assume that Western music notation was a useful tool for understanding non-Western musical traditions. It is only in recent years that this assumption has been called into question. And of course, there is an interesting question here. For what are people to do, and how are they to understand any musical system at all, unless they use some notation system? Very few cultural systems in the world have developed a sophisticated system of notation that accurately captures the two necessary elements of pitch and time. The Western system developed an ability to notate pitch from as early as the 9th century. The notation of rhythm became possible from around the 12th century, and by the 14th century, Europe had developed a system of notation not far off from the modern system. The Chinese have a system, and one has been developed in India. But neither is capable of doing what the Western system of notation can do. And there is a perfectly easy means by which to demonstrate this fact. which is that Western ethnomusicologists can, with a very considerable degree of accuracy, capture the music of India, China, and almost every other musical tradition, while the same cannot be said the other way around. While India and China have their systems of notation, it is not the case that if you played a symphony by Mahler to Indian or Chinese musicologists, they would be able to write it down in their notation system and then perform the symphony back for you while reading from their notation system. The results would not sound even remotely the same. Indeed, the results would bear almost no resemblance to what had first been heard. The French-Israeli ethnomusicologist Simar Aram has devoted his life to the study of the complex music of Africa. In his works, Aram analyzes and notates the sophisticated polyphonic and polyrhythmic music of Africa. His work includes notation of the highly complex techniques of Central African music, a tradition that the composer Georgi Ligeti, who learned from Aram's work, described as opening the door to a new way of thinking about polyphony, one which is equally rich as, or even richer than, the European tradition. Yet, much as Ligeti and other composers gained from this knowledge, the transit remains one way. Although Aram was able to capture the complex music of Central Africa while using the Western system of notation, no African system exists that could notate and then even approximately replicate a piano concerto by Beethoven. This is not a value judgment. It is simply a matter of fact, and just one reason why the Western system of notation can be said to be of far greater utility than is any other existing system of notation, and therefore, if for no other reason, worth studying. Any reasonable analysis of the facts would recognize the truth of the situation discussed previously. And yet, to mention it is not just controversial, but contentious, particularly in the West. Not because it is untrue, but because it is inconvenient to some wider ideological purview. The fact that the system under assault from academics and others happens to be the system that is most effective stops seeming perverse once you understand that the reason it is under assault is not that it is the most effective system. The reason it is under assault is simply that it is Western. It is not as though this assault is happening in obscure quarters. Indeed, this land grab by certain scholars is happening at Oxford University, among many other places. In March 2021, professors of the music faculty were shown a new set of proposals that said that, arising from international Black Lives Matter demonstrations, the faculty board proposed making changes to enhance the diversity of the undergraduate curriculum. Why should the music faculty of Oxford University feel impelled to make any changes because of the BLM movement? Only for the same reason that everyone else is expected to. Among the highlights of the music faculty's deliberations was one professor's branding musical notation itself as a colonialist representational system. Elsewhere, professors were told that the current undergraduate course demonstrated complicity in white supremacy and focused too much on white European music from the slave period, by which the professors meant the era of Mozart and Beethoven. A faculty member who decides on which courses should form the degree complained that the course's white hegemony had to be addressed. It was also claimed that teaching musical literacy in a notation system that had not shaken off its connection to its colonial past would be a slap in the face for certain students. Skills such as learning to play a keyboard instrument or learning to conduct orchestras should apparently no longer be part of the course because the relevant repertoire structurally centres white European music, causing students of colour great distress. Naturally, it was also complained that the majority of teachers in these relevant specialisms are white men. Finally, it was said that the structure of our curriculum supports white supremacy, not only because of the almost all-white faculty, but because it was giving privilege to white musics. One suggestion for alternative courses was that Oxford University should introduce new courses in pop music and popular culture. One example of a potential area of study being artists demanding Trump stop using their songs. As though to show that there is always another circle in the inferno, within weeks of that announcement, it was the turn of the Royal Academy of Music to announce what it was planning to do in reaction to the death of George Floyd. According to the Academy, it was now necessary to look at everything in a new light, including its world-renowned collection of 22,000 rare instruments. According to a spokesperson for the institution, which was founded in 1822, there was an ongoing commitment to making our curriculum more diverse, but it was also necessary to take the opportunity to view the collection which has been built up over two centuries through a decolonization lens. Who or what might be the victims of this cull? All that seemed to be known was that the Academy had links with George Frederick Handel, previously best known for writing The Messiah, but now better known for having invested in a company that owned slaves. Elsewhere, it seemed that several ivory keyboards might need to be decolonized. Nobody knows what was going through the mind of George Floyd during the last terrible minutes of his life, but it might have surprised him to learn that his death could lead to a purge of historic harpsichords at one of London's premier music conservatories. And the problem for so much of the era is that the political assertions do have practical consequences. It is not just that theoretical discussions occur in music faculty discussion meetings. It is that the same rebarbative, retributive worldview is run with everywhere. Eventually, everything becomes viewed through the same negative, hostile light, even in the arts, where works created in a spirit of generosity, sincerity, and tribute are now labelled as works of appropriation or colonialism. Cultural appropriation. In her New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race, Ijeoma Oluo tried to define what cultural appropriation actually is. She takes several runs at it. At its core, cultural appropriation is about ownership of one's culture, and since culture is defined both collectively and individually, the definition and sentiment about cultural appropriation changes with one's identification and sentiment about aspects of their culture. Perhaps aware that this sentence does not make matters completely clear, Oluo has the grace to say that there is an explanation for this. The sentence may sound really complicated, but that's because it is. And this, she suggests, may be one reason that cultural appropriation has been a difficult concept for many. Yet again, she tries to simplify it, and in yet another run, printed in bold this time, she informs us that we can broadly define the concept of cultural appropriation as the adoption or exploitation of another culture by a more dominant culture. Examples that Oluo gives include the wearing of Indian headdresses as casual fashion, certain Halloween costumes, and white people's rapping. When it comes to whether or not white people ought to be able to rap, Oluo says that legally they should be allowed to do so. The law should not prohibit it. But, she says, whether you can or should do something is a different matter. According to critics such as Oluo, white people's taking culture that is not theirs is wrong for two main reasons. The first is that they cannot know or share the roots of the culture that they are appropriating, and that it hurts people who have been born into that culture to see others attempt to absorb it without feeling their pain. The second is that white people who appropriate other cultures apparently go on to make money from their appropriations, often unfairly. So, when a white rapper makes money from a record deal, for instance, they are earning money that has effectively been stolen from a non-white person who could have done the same task at least as well, if not better. Of course, a number of problems arise from such assertions. Not the least of them is that such assertions presume that cultural pain is constant, unending, and unshareable. More prosaically, they present a range of practical problems. For instance, is it permissible to engage in the culture of another group so long as you do not excel at it? If you are bad at engaging in that culture, then how bad does it have to be before it is insulting? And how good does it have to be before this engagement starts to constitute a threat? What are people to do if they are partly of the tradition in question, but not wholly so? If only one of their parents or one of their grandparents happens to be of the tradition that they would like to engage with? One demonstration that those who make assertions such as these have not really thought about the consequences of their claims can be seen in the fact that their examples are so consistently flippant. Once again, Oluo claims that cultural appropriation is the product of a society that prefers its culture cloaked in whiteness, and a society that only respects culture cloaked in whiteness. The examples she gives of this are peoples wearing feathered headdresses to Coachella and white college kids wearing dreadlocks. Oluo wrestles with herself slightly over whether people should be allowed to borrow from other cultures, but concludes that marginalized cultures must be heard. And if that means your conscience won't allow you to dress as a geisha for Halloween, know that even then, in the grand scheme of things, you are not the victim. Yet the grand scheme of things appears to be the last thing on the mind of those who talk of appropriation. Very few people would go to the wall for the right to wear a Native American headdress to Coachella or to dress as a geisha for Halloween. Indeed, the obsession with Halloween costumes in US discussions of cultural appropriation displays not just immaturity, but a deliberate unwillingness to confront the serious, sincere, and profound exchanges that actually distinguish the history not just of Western art and culture, but of world culture. By focusing on costumes or hair braids, the opponents of cultural appropriation make the job too easy for themselves. And they ignore, whether through malice or ignorance, the much bigger questions that loom up behind. Cultural admiration. For the history of Western culture is not a story of cultural appropriation. It is far more accurate to describe it as a story of cultural admiration. For centuries, European artists and composers looked around the world not with detestation, but with admiration, even veneration. They wanted to look at everything that the world outside had to offer. And when they appropriated aspects of the culture of a group other than the group they happened to have been born into, they did so not out of a desire to monetize the results or to steal the pain of other people, but as a way to understand the human condition and reflect it in all its richness. Take one of the great oratorios of the 20th century. Even as Michael Tippett was writing it in the 1930s and 1940s, his A Child of Our Time was in an idiom that was out of fashion. The great oratorios of the 19th century were big beasts, remote from what Tippett then saw as the urgent political cataclysm of his day. But he was spurred to write one of his greatest works by an urgent recent event. In November 1938, a young Jewish man called Herschel Grinspan assassinated a German diplomat in Paris. The Nazis immediately used this as a pretext for what became known in Germany as Kristallnacht. With Jewish homes and Jewish-owned businesses systematically destroyed with state coordination. As news drifted out from the continent, the young, radically left-wing and pacifist composer in England began imagining a musical response to the growing violence and racial discrimination engulfing the continent. And, as he contemplated a musical response to a world that was beginning to turn on its dark side, he was gifted a magnificent idea. Sometime early in 1939, Tippett heard a broadcast on the radio in England that included a number of African-American spirituals, then known as Negro spirituals. Such spirituals were fairly popular at the time and already performed with some frequency. But this particular performance moved Tippett greatly. He had known a number of the spirituals since his school days during World War I, and had most likely heard a concert of spirituals while he was a student at the Royal College of Music in 1925. But this performance struck a profound chord, and he instantly sought out the black writer James Weldon Johnson's two-volume edition of spirituals. From there, Tippett conceived the idea of interspersing these spirituals at crucial moments within his oratorio. Much as Bach includes Lutheran chorales during his Passions, so at climactic moments of this modern oratorio, Tippett included Steal Away, Nobody Knows the Trouble I See, Lord, Go Down Moses, Oh By and By, and finally, and perhaps most movingly, at the very end of the work, Deep River. The chorus and soloists sing, I shall know my shadow and my light. And then, after the difficult, contorted harmonic passages that accompany it, the performers all finally fall into the deep balm of this great spiritual. Deep River, my home is over Jordan. Deep River, Lord, I want to cross over into campground, that land where all is peace. The spirituals from A Child of Our Time were such a success that the composer eventually did a separate arrangement of them that got performed as often, if not more often, than the oratorio itself. Their popularity helped make Tippett's pacifist oratorio his most performed work, one that has moved audiences around the world for generations. Tippett himself attended performances around the world, including a multiracial performance in the Cathedral of Lusaka in Zambia before the country's president, several of the era's great sopranos, including Faye Robinson and Jessie Norman, distinguished the work through their performances of it. In 1966, Tippett went to conduct a performance at a school in Baltimore and was, as his biographer has written, delighted to find the choir a mixture of black and white singers. It was performances such as these in the country that had gifted him the spirituals that he felt most moved by. A friend of his related, that on at least one occasion when the work was performed in America, of course, all the audience started to sing the spirituals, and it made him weep, apparently. Almost makes me weep to see him telling me. Just as Bach's congregations would have known the chorales in the Passions, here was the place where the songs had come from, and, to the joy of the composer, the audience joined in with them as their own. Nothing Tippett ever wrote in the decades afterward, even his Third Symphony, which in its text quotes directly from the words of Martin Luther King Jr., ever gained the emotional and popular appeal of that great work of World War II. Yet, in recent years, all this, like everything else, has come to be portrayed in a different light. As early as 2000, there were people complaining that Tippett had no right to use spirituals from a tradition he did not belong to. At the time of a performance in Los Angeles by the Los Angeles Philharmonic, several musicologists complained that the inclusion of the spirituals was worrisome. Though sincerely intended, they can seem, one critic claimed, like cultural appropriation. Today's world, they complained, did not properly acknowledge the contribution of African-American music in the Western canon, and the conductor Roger Norrington joined in, claiming that there was a risk that Tippett was turning spirituals into early afternoon tea, which is a generalizing claim to make in itself. In America, proposed performances of the work have been stopped, as students have complained about cultural appropriation and even the simple fact that the spirituals were known in their day as Negro spirituals. While that term may not be acceptable today, it was simply the term of the day, and stripped of all context or even an attempt at understanding, it seems that this great work now stands as yet another casualty of campaigners and others willfully trying not to understand the context or intent of the work. At the time Tippett was writing, the very performance of the spirituals he used would have been banned in Nazi Germany, which would have forbidden them as Negermusik. But at the very moment that this would have been the case in Germany, an English composer raised up that very same art and gave it a platform for the whole world to admire and share in. It is commonly said that if someone is going to use the music of a different culture, then they should at least encourage the people from that culture to perform their own music. But how many presumptions are bound up in that? If no African or African-American is available to sing the spiritual, should it go unsung? And why, if you wish to promote or protect a particular cultural expression, would you go after precisely the people trying to bring that culture to a wider audience? Of all people, why go after them? There is something not just sad, but shameful about an era trying so hard not to admire, appreciate, or even just understand the hopes and dreams of earlier days, as though everybody who dreamed or created before the present must be found to have slipped up somewhere and then be cast aside for good. Cultural approbation. But that is just one of the problems of the ravenous expression of opprobrium now known as cultural appropriation. For the idea, spun off so mean-spiritedly from the American Academy, does not simply claim that artists and others must stay in their lane. It surveys the vast savanna of past creativity and sees it in a light that is solely negative. It looks to Western art and attempts to see it as a history of illegitimate acquisition and theft. What it resolutely fails to do is to recognize the spirit not just of generosity, but of deep tribute that the history of Western art has always expressed when it met non-Western traditions. It is exceptionally easy to claim that Western artists, like Western explorers, soldiers, and botanists, merely saw the world outside of Europe as a place to artistically rape and pillage. What it refuses to recognize is that almost none of the work now interpreted in this light was created with such a mean or meaningless intent. For many centuries, the history of painting in Europe was slow to pick up outside techniques simply because artists, like everyone else, were unaware of cultures that were then beyond their known world. But when painters, composers, and other artists did find their way outward from Europe, it was with a wonder and a respect that bears no resemblance to the spirit in which their actions are now commonly interpreted. From the late 18th and early 19th centuries, painters such as Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres and Eugène Delacroix were fascinated by the world of North Africa. Exoticism was not something they had contempt for. It was something they were passionately interested in and inspired by. Paintings such as Ingres' Odalisque and Delacroix's Women of Algiers, both now in the Louvre, were not robberies from North Africa. They are an extension of a long history in Western art of wanting to find out about everything, including what had previously been unknown. In the time of Leonardo da Vinci, human anatomy was a type of unknown country.